Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Hello, everybody, and welcome once again to the View from the Lane, multi-award-winning Tottenham Hotspur podcast from The Athletic. I'm your host, Danny Kelly, and with me today are The Athletic's Charlie Eccleshare and James Moore. Hello to them. On today's episode, among no doubt many other winding tributaries, we'll discuss Spurs moving back into the top four after last night's 3-1 win over Nottingham Forest in what, again, I found myself dubbing a must-win game for Spurs because of their upcoming fixtures. They did it in the end. James, you were there. Well, of course, let me just say, first of all, that the club and I guess the fans did very, very well to get the game on around the very unfortunate death of a person outside the stadium. So well done to the police, the authorities, Spurs and the fans for getting themselves into the stadium in an orderly fashion, even while the police were still investigating. Meanwhile, Spurs won by 3-1. And James, I put it to you that the two substitutions, seeing Bissouma and Sargov at half-time for Højbjerg and Bentancur, were the turning point. Is that right?
Yeah, I'd say that's probably fair to say. I mean, I don't think they played especially badly in the first half. Even those two players, Sar and Bissouma, that got taken off. Sar was maybe a bit more quiet than usual, but I thought was doing okay. And Bissouma was pretty neat and tidy. I mean, I think we might come onto this, but he'd clearly been told, feel free to have a few shots, feel free to let fly from the edge of the box. I mean, unless that was the reason he was taken off, of course, that he wasn't told that and that he just did it anyway.
Well, this all came from me asking him about it on Friday.
One thing as well, some fans want to see against low blocks, players taking more shots from range. And I'm just wondering, I know this
you're just wondering if that's how I coach, or do a poll amongst supporters and say, what do you reckon we need this
week? No. This is a very niche question, but I just mean like in a game model like yours, is that just like a side point? You know, is that something you would ever talk about against a certain team? There will be spaces. Can we have more shots from distance rather than that kind of, you know, more intricate way of playing?
Okay. Yeah, so are my players allowed to shoot?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Do they get fined if they shoot?
I get that. You probably would have had that a lot. Yes, they're allowed to shoot. Yeah. No, look, it's you know, as I said the other night, there was some opportunities there that we probably, you know, we kind of rushed things in terms of, you know, the way we could create more opportunities for ourselves. But again, I always think those kind of things are just a moment in time. I think if you look at the goals we've scored this year, I can remember at least, you know, two or three, Sonny in particular, scoring from outside the box. So it's not something that, you know, there's no, especially in that front third, a lot of it is around the quality of your players and the instinctiveness on your players and all the teams I've had. I try and make it as less structured in that front third as possible, but you always, I think, achieve better outcomes or more possibilities, more avenues to goal, because ultimately that's what my teams want to do, score goals, and they always have, is, you know, by creating some sort of fluency that allows players to make the best decisions in there.
I asked him, why aren't they taking so many shots? 2 days later, it's raining shots from Yves Bissouma.
All right, so I found an amazing stat that we'll come on to later, but what I was actually trying to find was something different. Charlie might know the answer to this. How many goals have Spurs scored from outside the box this season? Because I feel like it can't be that many.
Well, it's funny because when I asked Ange about it, when he then got into answering, he was like, you know, and I can think of lots of goals we've scored this season. Then he sort of tailed off as he was actually trying to think of it. He was like, yeah, you know, there've definitely been two or three. There was Pedro Porro in the FA Cup.
Romero against Burnley early in the season.
Yeah. He said a Son one as well. I was trying to remember what that would have been. Madison at Burnley was outside the box, wasn't
it? Yeah. Was one of the Son ones at Burnley, the third one? I don't know. One was kind of a ball.
One was a pass from Porro that he was through on goal. I mean, if it was, then it's not really the kind of one we're talking about because it's basically a one-on-one. But I really can't think of many.
Yeah, there haven't been many. And it just did feel like there had been an instruction because in the first half, like I say, Bissouma let fly a few times. One or two other players did as well. And then, you know, as we all know, Van der Ven let rip with a ludicrous shot from the edge of the box early in the second half that effectively won the game.
Well, I mean, Van der Ven and Porro... shooting boots on, it's fair to say. So, Charlie, I need you for the rest of the season to guide these press conferences around what we decide here on the View from the Lane the team needs. And by poking the bear with them at your questions about how Spurs are playing, we might be able to get this response in every game. In which case, ask him why the left side of the defence doesn't bother to defend. I don't mean Udogie, I mean the whole team. Why is it that that's where the goals are all coming from against us just now? And see if he can fix up for us.
It does seem to be specifically when they're shooting in that direction at home as well. Because I can picture a lot of goals that they've conceded, like as you're watching on TV, near side, down to the right. Right, Luton, we did this then. Wolves, one of the Wolves goals. Brentford, I think, one of the first Brentford goal in that game.
The corner we conceded that led to the goal the other day as well. It's the same opposition move over and over and over again.
Yeah. I mean, I mean that isn't a coincidence. Either. That is both like a weakness of a team and a thing that opponents are clearly looking to exploit. And you say it's not Udogie, but... I would suggest that's maybe a little bit generous. I mean, this one was the spacing behind, wasn't it? Because he had pushed right up to the halfway line, which obviously is what he's supposed to do. But if Van de Ven immediately gets drawn out, Romero leaves a bit of space, the player runs into it, then suddenly it's kind of, they're at twos and threes all over the place and it is incredibly hard to prevent a very good opportunity. And that's exactly what happened.
You were saying before we got distracted there and how easily distracted we are, thankfully. And of course, James has been building up this big statistic since we met a few minutes ago to get ready for the show. So I'm looking forward to when he drops it in the modern parlance into wherever we go. But they weren't playing that badly in the first half, but they played much better in the second. And so I repeat my question to you, Charlie. Was it the substitutions that made the difference?
Yeah, they definitely helped. And I mean, Bentancur obviously got the assist for Porro's goal. He was involved in Van de Ven's goal as well with a little decoy run. And that was all Postecoglou referred to the fact that was kind of a training ground routine. And Højbjerg was good as well.
Højbjerg was brilliant, by the way. I thought Højbjerg was amazing. Really, really good. Like genuinely really, really good.
I kind of feel confident they would have won this game with Bissouma and Saar also in midfield. Just in the sense that I don't think... You know, I always felt they were a bit like, I remember when you were talking about the Luton game, James, you were saying, you know, at no point, and that was different circumstances, at no point did you not think they were going to win, but I had the same feeling here. You know, I always thought they would turn it on in the second half. And even, you know, had Forrest gone ahead, which they might well have done with that Chris Wood chance, I still think Spurs probably would have won 3-2 or 4-2 in the second half. But yeah, they did come on, gave, you know, a lot of energy. Højbjerg came on, had that shot almost straight away in the second half that was tipped over well. As Postecoglou said, it's just great to have options. You know, he said it wasn't anything Biss or Pat did. I just thought I have the luxury of a strong squad now, which I didn't for the middle part of the year. I thought we needed some energy and legs.
It is great to have options, but that's twice now. He's substituted two-thirds of the midfield halfway through the game. And I mean halfway through, well, less than halfway through the game, because we know that the second half is going to last for anything up to 100 minutes. There's something not quite, you know, Spurs won, very important victory, top four, get all that. Something not quite clicking with that midfield, isn't there, at the moment? None of them are in the form that they can show. I'm talking about Saar, Bissouma and James Maddison.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think the other way to frame it is that, you know, the Premier League now is a five subs game, and it's fine if when you've got a deep squad that you eventually find the right combination for that particular game. But yeah, I mean, obviously in an ideal world, you'd have Maddison playing like he did in those first 10 games of the season, Bissouma playing like he did in the early weeks of the season, and Saar has had this back issue that he's been managing, and he hasn't looked quite as dangerous in the last few weeks. But yeah, if it's not working out, it's great to be able to have players of the quality of Bentancur and Højbjerg to come on and change things. And it's not the first time Højbjerg's come on at half time and, you know, really helped change a game. He did it against Brentford as well in that 3-2 win.
I'm not pretending that he's Zico or anything, but the grief that Pierre-Emile Højbjerg gets is ridiculous. He is a good, established Premier League player of a, you know, 6.5 minimum out of 10 most weeks. You don't discard these people lightly.
Well, do you know which Spurs, how many Spurs outfielders have got more Premier League appearances this season than Højbjerg?
I suspect zero.
It is zero. He's clear in front. He's got 30. The next is Kulusevski with 29. Obviously, only six of those are starts, but he has been, he's played in all but one of Spurs' games and, you know, has contributed in most of them.
I mean, the interesting thing will be if we, and more importantly, Postecoglou thinks he is the best player to start or one of the three best players to start in midfield for Spurs in the remaining seven games. Will he do that, or will he continue to take this kind of longer-term view? I.e., if he thinks Saar and Bissouma is his kind of deeper midfield partnership for the next X years, does he persist with that for the next seven games in order to like force it to work or to help it work? Or does he stick with the player who we suspect might leave in the summer? Interesting question. I mean, look, other people might think that Højbjerg shouldn't even start at Newcastle or in the other games. I mean, like, it's like open for debate, but it's an interesting topic of conversation, I think.
It is. I think he'll just, as boring as it sounds, or certainly his answer would be, like, he will just pick on merit. And, you know, obviously he's not as results obsessed as some. And yeah, process, growth, all of these words are massively important. Would you start Højbjerg against Newcastle? I think it's hard to make that case, even as well as he played.
Particularly because he's done so well off the bench so often. Like, I mean, obviously you want him to be involved at some point in that game, you imagine. But like, yeah, it's difficult to, you know, having said that Saar and Bissouma didn't play badly, and then Bentancur came on and played well too. Like, you'd probably favour probably two of those three over him, I think, whatever happens.
When you say, you know, would you start him at Newcastle, that question can be inverted. Would you start Saar and Bissouma as a pair, you know?
I'm sorry, was that a rhetorical question? Or
No, of course it was a fantastic question. It's left you both foundering for any kind of answer that might entertain the public.
What I would say about that too is they are the two that started the season. And when, you know, Spurs' best period of form in the season was those first 10 games when those two and Maddison were the three that played, I imagine, started every single game possibly, with the exception of that Brentford one at the start when Skip played, maybe. But since then, it was those three, and their record was obviously incredibly good. And we were kind of asking what's going to happen to Bentancur. Is he going to get back in the team, or is he going to be made to wait? And obviously, we had an incredibly high opinion of Bentancur. So the idea that it can't work with that combination of players, you know, is probably a little bit short-sighted. But at the same time, it has been probably at least that long again that they've been playing and not playing as well now. So, yeah, it's difficult to know.
I want to get on to the two second-half goals. I'm going to say this about Van de Ven's goal. Recency bias. I believe that's my favourite Spurs goal of all time. I mean, the wallop he put on that. I mean, he's a big lad, isn't he? And he's obviously, his levers, because of the speed he runs it, you can tell his levers were very well coordinated. But my God, that was, you know, people make up these compound words like thunder bastard, but there's no way of humanly expressing the power of that shot, is there?
I'm trying to think of a goal that I've seen in the flesh to compare that to. And there was one that Obafemi Martin scored for Newcastle down that
end
of White Hart Lane. So it's probably from a sort of similar point on the pitch, but like obviously 100 yards down the high road, I guess.
Wasn't that was the quickest shot in Premier League history at the time, I'm pretty
sure. Yeah. And I had kind of had a down the barrel view of that from like behind him. And it moves like it just was just freakish the way it moves. And that is what I would compare that goal to see that in the flesh. I mean, I don't know how you felt about that, Charlie, but like you see that so rarely. Someone hit a shot that cleanly that moves that quickly. Like it's really got weird to see it happen.
It was weird. Like on the it goes in the goal noticeably way quicker than most goals do. It was suddenly in the back of the net.
It was still and accelerating, wasn't it? As it hit the net, which is unusual,
And it almost caught sort of the crowd by surprise as like a split second to kind of realise what's happened. I mean, it was a game for kind of extraordinary efforts. There was that one and there was the one in the first half from Murillo. And I was looking down at my desk sort of typing something and Dan Kilpatrick next to me just says something like, oh my God, like sort of made this noise.
Vicario's face as well as he runs back towards the goal.
I think if that's on target, it's in. I mean... because you might say like, oh, might Vicario have, you know, did he have it covered to any degree? I mean, no, it was just...
It was way madder than I thought. Honestly, like, having seen that in the stadium, and I was paying attention. It wasn't like the Paul Robinson goal against Watford. I was actually watching this time. But it was... It's just the last thing you expect a player to do in that situation. And, like, I was thinking about it on the way home, and I thought it was, like, it was just inside his own half. It was, like, 30 yards inside, miles away from the halfway.
The only one I could... Do you remember the Figueroa one for Wigan, where he took... It was actually a free kick.
Yeah, but did he mean to shoot?
Yeah. He meant to shoot. And he's inside his own half, and it's a similar kind of trajectory.
Not by miles, though.
No. So this is obviously... This is quite a bit further out, but the shape of it and the fact it's the left footer just kind of leathering it from the left side.
Well, like I said, I thought it had gone in.
And I think I can combine the two bits of conversation here. Having watched Van de Ven's goal, less than 50 times, my fear is if he'd hit the crossbar, the rebound would have beaten Vicario. Absolutely. It would have gone so fast and he'd have been so far out of his goal, I think that might easily have been a goal for the opposition. And I'm usually right about these things, aren't I? I think we can all agree on that. Equally, it was great to see Porro... finally, I think he's had, until that moment, the most shots by any Premier League player without being on the score sheet.
In the league, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. He scored in the FA Cup, yeah. Yeah, but I think in Premier League shots, he's had more than a... And it was a delight to see it lamp in as well. I mean, obviously, it was like a sort of a beach ball compared to what happened with Van de Ven, but it was still a pretty brilliant strike. I loved it.
Yeah, he's been unlucky, and he got three in not that many games last season after he joined. And obviously he didn't really get talked about that much because Spurs were such a mess, but he showed he can, you know, in the famous Conte rant game against Southampton, Porro scored a brilliant goal. He absolutely smashes one into the roof of the net.
All of his goals have been really good, haven't they? I mean, obviously that long ranger against Burnley that you mentioned earlier, that one against Southampton, it was a really good finish. Was it Leeds last
season? Leeds on the last day. Really good finish, yeah.
So he's clearly got like very good technique. That was I'd be interested to hear what other people thought of that goal, because in the moment it felt like an amazing goal. Obviously, like overshadowed by Van de Ven, which is, I think, just felt like an incredibly rare thing. But like the move was brilliant, and that little touch by Benson Kerr, which you know, it definitely was like cushioned into the path of a teammate. But yeah, it was a brilliant goal.
Yeah, it's one of those, you know, Spurs have done this several times this season where they get one goal and they suddenly build up a head of steam. And every pass goes to feet for about 10 minutes. And whether Bentancur meant that exact cushion header or not, the fact of the matter is Spurs were flooding the opposition penalty area by that stage. And then there was always going to be three white shirts because there were times when I was watching it, Spurs were running, Werner would have the ball and they were running six and seven players into the penalty area. Man, I loved it. And man, I contrasted it with some of the shit I've had to watch in the last 3 years.
Yeah, I would say this performance was as close to a complete performance as we've seen from Spurs for a while. Like, there have been a lot of games where they've played incredibly well for like 15, 20 minutes and won a game within a short period of a match and then kind of clung on a bit, or it's been incredibly open for the rest. But in this game, very, very good for that first 20 minutes, conceded the goal against the run of play, were a bit iffy then for maybe 20, 25 minutes for the second half of the first half. But then the second half, the rest of the entire second half, pretty much, they're incredibly good. Against a Forest team, and this is another fantastic stat I'm going to drop in here now. I've done so much research. Honestly, since the start of November, Forest have only lost by more than one goal four times. And two of those have been against Spurs.
I mean, yeah, I think the that period afterwards scored was... That was the kind of the lull, wasn't it? And Wood, had he not taken the most Chris Wood approach to an open goal from 3 yards, then they might well have gone in front.
Do you have to praise the keeper there? Has the keeper made himself so big that he's like giving him...
He does all he can do, for sure. He makes himself big and sort of gets himself in Wood's eye line, but it's still an extraordinary response.
We have got so much to get through today, but I still want to do one or two other things from the match. Timo Werner, still perhaps not Vinicius Jr., but getting better and better, Charlie, it seems to me, as he gets used to the team.
Yeah, I wrote a piece on him after the game. I kind of just think like now we're at a point where for him, for all the kind of divisiveness that he supposedly brings, I feel like when everyone's sort of now agreed on him that he's not ever going to be this kind of... you know, really polished player who always shows loads of finesse. I mean, this game kind of summed him up. I thought he was really good. Within that, there was a cross that went, you know, looped out for a goal kick, because he's never going to be perfect. He's never going to be a sort of clinical finisher. We saw that against Luton when he went through and missed a really good chance. But he's really effective in this team. And the idea, you know, for 15 million is the buy option. To have him as an option. And again, I don't think anyone is suggesting, right, we don't need to go and buy a winger anymore. We've got Timo Werner. Of course, that's not the case. Or I certainly don't think that. They need someone, you know, he's not going to take them on another level. But to be a useful option, absolutely, they should get him in for that. You know, 15 million's nothing in the current market. As he did for Chelsea, he gets you a goal or an assist every other game. Perfectly decent. And the way Spurs want to play, rapid, direct, building attacks from the flanks, he's great. He got it's not an assist because it's an own goal, which I think is ridiculous, because it was a brilliant assist. He then set one up for Johnson, could have been another assist. He got the one for Johnson, very similar kind of
ball.
That's
a lot of contributions you're already mentioning in any game of football, yeah. The complication, guys, comes if Spurs sign a striker, isn't it? A straightforward centre forward, because then Son plays wide left and anybody, Manuel Solomon, Timo Werner, whoever... Brian Hill, God bless him, they're going to get very limited game time.
Yeah, but Danny, you're talking about it as if like they'll actually have a set 11 that they can play regularly. We know that, especially if they're in the Champions League next season and injuries happen, suspensions happen, they might have a run in one or both cups. They need a bigger squad. They need a carousel of six forwards of a quality that you say, okay, they can play these games. And I think Werner is at that level. That's what they need. And so whether they bring in another number nine and that means his game time's limited, who cares, quite frankly? For 15 million, even if he's mainly coming off the bench and with five subs, you know, he would be most games, that's totally fine. That would be great. If you know, the lower down he is on the pecking order, in inverted commas, because Postecoglou doesn't believe in such a thing, kind of the better for Tottenham. You know, if he's just an impact player, great.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the team's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new, Thursdays on FX, stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, You heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
The next question I've got on the running order, well, yes, we actually have a formal running order in front of me. I don't understand the question. It says, race for Champions League over? Is that the assumption that we're going to get the fifth place through the coefficient, yeah? Okay, the mysterious voice of the producer says that he is presuming that we're going to get the fifth place, in which case Spurs and Aston Villa would, I could think, James, look pretty comfortable.
Yes, I mean, I've been fairly positive about Manchester United being terrible for most of the second half of the season. And I don't, despite them inexplicably getting a point against Liverpool on Sunday, I don't see them getting... I mean, I would say they're probably going to struggle to get to 60 points. Are they going to get 11 points from their last seven games? Could you say that of any degree of certainty? I don't think you could.
They're awful. Come on. If Spurs... I'm sorry, they're so bad. And if Spurs finish below United... I've said this for a while. If Spurs finish below them, they don't deserve to be in the Champions League or anywhere near it, quite frankly, because they are so much better than United. This United team are dreadful. They've got an 11-point lead on them with seven games to go. I would say with absolute certainty, I can say that now, and you can clip this up and shove it in my face if I'm wrong, there is no way that Spurs are finishing below Manchester United. It's just not going to happen.
A really important win. Important for me psychologically because Spurs have had several invitations to go into the top four in recent weeks and have declined them. RSVP, no thank you. And that gap between Spurs, Villa and Manchester United does indeed look very tasty now. And despite the genuine difficulty of the running for both Villa and Tottenham, even I'm starting to feel a little more comfortable. Provided what you two tell me about the coefficient turns out not to be so much nonsense.
The one spanner I would
throw
in the works.
Oh no, a spanner.
and I've seen a couple of people mention this. Newcastle, and I'm sure Charlie will poo-poo this, a Newcastle's running is compared to all of those other teams, including West Ham, incredibly straightforward. I mean, they do have a game at Old Trafford against the aforementioned Comedy Club, but if they were to beat Spurs on Saturday, the rest of their running after that is Palace, Sheffield United, Burnley, Brighton at home, Brentford away. It's not the most punishing, and certainly not in comparison to Villa and Spurs, Manchester United. I don't know. They're in slightly better form now than they were earlier in the year. I know they drew at home with Everton last week.
If Newcastle come back from that 13-point deficit, then they deserve to be in the Champions League, don't they?
I think it's more a case of if Newcastle overhaul Spurs from here, then Spurs don't deserve to be in the Champions League. But they would probably be the team out of that group below Villa that I'd worry about the most, just purely on the basis that they have, I would say they're most likely to get a decent number of points.
I mean, it's been a mad year this year. It's only this week that Chelsea are now mathematically incapable of winning the title. Because the top three don't play each other, and so there's a possibility they will get no more points. Until Chelsea dropped those points the other day, they were still in with a mathematical chance of being champions of England. That field is reduced to five now, including Spurs and Aston Villa.
In the mix. I'm glad we're talking about Chelsea. I can't really explain this. Drawing at Sheffield United is funnier than losing.
It was a brilliant result for Chelsea. Look at the stats. They were absolutely overrun. Look at the stats. They could have lost 5-2 there. No problem. That's a really good result. Pochettino should be getting a bonus for that.
And a home draw against Burnley. I mean, Newcastle, just on Newcastle, if Spurs win those games against Burnley and Sheffield United, then they could lose all the others and Newcastle would have to win all seven of their remaining games. So it would, it really would be a kind of collapse and a surge for the ages.
The thing I worry about is that, having said, what was that thing I said the other week, that Spurs have a good record against, Spurs would beat one of those teams in that run because they've got a good record against Arsenal and City, and they're unlikely to lose four or five games in a row. Because I've said that on a podcast, sort of feels like that's the thing that will get clipped up, and I'll be on Twitter in at the end of May looking like a dickhead.
I mean, I have to say, I remain pretty confident Spurs will finish ahead of Villa, let alone, you know, the worry about fifth.
Well, they've not been in brilliant form since like Christmas, really. I know they've won like a decent number of games in that time, but they've not like strong wins. I mean, you could argue Spurs haven't either.
Well, I was going to say that they've been in often quite a similar sort of position to what Spurs have been doing. That just they've got what looked like they had Villa won three games in a row, kind of February into March. But yeah, they've then it's been quite patchy. And I think having to manage Europe, I mean, because what may happen, they may feel emboldened if it's becoming apparent that fifth is going to get it. They may feel emboldened to really go for the Conference League, because, you know, fifth and winning the Conference League obviously would be an amazing season for them.
And if they get past Lille, then that was the, I mean, they were unfortunate, Aston Villa, fortunate for Spurs that they in the quarterfinal they've drawn the toughest team left in that tournament. So that if they get past Lille, then they will be odds on to win it. And they may well change their mind and go for it.
Spurs do have the opportunity to really put the pressure on. Villa go away to Arsenal on Sunday. If Spurs can go and get a result at Newcastle, they'd be, what, 3 points clear, and with that better goal difference.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Now, last night, some sad news came for Spurs fans of a certain vintage, football fans in general, that the former Wimbledon manager and Spurs defender Joe Kinnear had died at the age of 77. Joe Kinnear played for Spurs for 10 years, and I watched most of those games, so I think I can speak with some expertise here. He won four trophies with Spurs, an FA Cup when he was a very young player, and we'll come on to that in a second, where he was the man of the match in the 67 final against Chelsea. He won two League Cups in the early 70s and the UEFA Cup. So trophy-laden, you could say. Just for your information, guys, he was a quick, tenacious and attacking-minded fullback. And there was a time when Spurs had him on at right back and Cyril Knowles at left back where they were the second best pair of fullbacks in the Premier League, in the old First Division. I suspect that Leeds combinations of Paul Reaney and Terry Cooper were better. In fact, I know they were better. But they were really brilliant players. And he was a real personality as well, Joe Kinnear, in and around that team. This is from somebody else's book writing about Joe Kinnear. In 1967, still just a youngster, fresh to the first team, Joe was in the Spurs team that won the FA Cup at Wembley against Chelsea. He was only 19, the youngest player on the pitch, and was the man of the match by many newspapers' judgment. The sudden rush of money went to his head. His bonuses just for winning the cup came to £2,500. He gave £500 at once to his mother, gave each of his four sisters £30 and a completely new outfit, bought his grandmother in Dublin a TV and an armchair, bought himself a Vauxhall Corsair at £600, and then took the whole family of eight, including his grandmother, for a six-week holiday in Ireland till the rest of the money ran out. I couldn't wait to get rid of it, he said. So I think Joe's attitude to life might be summed up well in that. If I can have a quick personal reminiscence about him, then you two can tell me what you know about him, is that when I started Football 365 back in the day, it quickly became clear that the new technologies, the internet, was going to allow people not only to read about football, they want to hear about, you know, audio content. We decided to build a radio studio at 365, but we only had a cupboard in which to do it. So we put up the, you know, that pointy baffling for the sound and hung a microphone from the ceiling of a cupboard. The first person we did an interview with was Joe Kinnear, who came to the West End to do it, thinking it would be like the BBC's stylish studios in Egton House. In fact, of course, the cupboard was 4 foot by 4. We had to stand up to do the interview. Joe and I, by this stage of our illustrious lives, were both slightly well upholstered, I think it's fair to say. And so we were leaning belly to belly, and our noses about 3 inches apart as we did this 15-minute interview. And you know what? He did not flinch. He just did it, shook my hand, went away again. It was very, very funny for me just to be trapped in this tiny space. It was about the size of a phone box with another, you know, not tall, but quite roundy man. But he didn't complain at all, Joe. It was just another day at work for him. And, of course, his time as, you know, as Wimbledon manager is legendary. Some of the things he and that team did. But to me, he was part of a great Spurs team in the early 70s. Many of whom are legends. I wouldn't say, you know, we don't have to make a list of all the legends, but he was a brilliant Spurs player. And I felt a shock when I saw that he was gone.
Yeah, I mean, he was, you mentioned there about that Wimbledon team. That's probably, James, you as well. That's certainly my first memory of him entering my consciousness was, as a kid, him being, it felt like he had been their manager forever and would be their manager forever. He was so synonymous with that Wimbledon team. Then the other thing I really remember him was that infamous Newcastle press conference, which, you know, where he's absolutely going for a couple of reporters with pretty colourful language, which
I remember that kind of, when was it, like sort of 2009? I remember that was quite
2008,
early.
2008, I think, 2008. Yeah.
It was quite soon after I started working at 442, because we were like sat in the office of Sky Sports News on. And I don't think the actual press conference itself was like broadcast live, but the whole like hubbub about this press conference were like made itself quite evident quite quickly. I suppose it was like pre-Twitter, so it must have like appeared on forums or whatever. But it, like this kind of amazing sense of this ludicrous thing having happened, and a manager just completely putting a few journalists in their place, or as he saw it anyway.
Apparently he swore once every 6 seconds in the press conference. Apparently 36 F words, 4 B words, 6 C words.
Character and legend. And as I'll make the point again, a really good footballer for Spurs and the Republic of Ireland. Adam Nathan, regular contributor, of course. All things considered, could we really have expected that much more from the season than this? Thrilled with the way it's panned out and the situation we've found ourselves in. But I think we've kind of answered that in the first half of this podcast.
I do think the way the season's panned out is just a reminder that it's all about kind of the way things happen. Because we're in a position where it's like, oh, Spurs are obviously going to get Champions League, and it just feels like that there's not really any drama. And that almost allows you to forget what Adam's saying, that how much they've exceeded expectations and how good it's been. Whereas if they were like on a charge now, it would be like, I can't believe it. You know, if they'd started slowly under Postecoglou, as everyone expected, and now they were charging, it would be like, they're going to do it. This is amazing. This is one of the most dramatic capturings of a Champions League qualification that we never thought possible this season. Whereas now we're just like, oh yeah, they're going to get Champions League and we've still got 7 games to go.
I thought without Kane, this Spurs team would struggle. I thought it'd be 8th this season. So I have to eat humble pie and whatever else is these days the designation of humility.
If the producer wanted to find the clip of me saying without Kane, Spurs would finish 4th or 5th, fine. So be it. He can find it. It's there.
Is that your great stat?
No. My great stat is I've been correcting my predictions 84 times in the history of this podcast. No. My great stat...
Hang on a second. Before you do your great stat, ladies and gentlemen, it is time now. Hang on a second. Time for James's great stat. Time for you to present your stat.
So Spurs are 11 points off the top of the Premier League, which I think at this point of the season, after 31 games, feels actually pretty close. And so close, in fact, that you have to go back to 2017 for the last time that Spurs were closer to the top of the Premier League after 31 games, which is when they were 7 points behind Chelsea.
That's almost... So they're only 4 points further off than in that season where they... came second.
Yeah. I mean, go through the numbers. Last season, I'll just rattle through these. Last season, they were 21 behind. The season before, 17. The season before that, 25. The season before that, 19-20. They were 41 points behind. Obviously, that was Liverpool winning pretty much every game. So that's probably as much about that as it is about Spurs.
Actually, this is at the top of the Premier League. This is a vintage season. So to be close to 3 really good teams...
It is and it isn't. It's not points total wise.
No, it isn't because they've had to play each other and all the rest of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like that. And
there. Here comes the poo pooing.
No. I was just poo pooing that particular bit of the stat. As in, they're not going to, no one's going to be getting like high 90s. The team who wins it will get about 90, probably, maybe high 80s.
Let's finish with some more statue updates. Again, thank you all who've made any attempt to find statues and, you know, and the add ons of plaques, portraits, etc. Of Spurs fans. It turns out these are Spurs players. Somebody who shall remain anonymous because we can't be bothered to look their name up on email sent us a picture of Pat Jennings in front of his own statue in the town of Newry, where he's from, of course. And it's actually very good because, you know, some of the statues we've been talking about on here are, frankly, the Harry Kane one was the absolute ne plus ultra of that, are not very good. But that's a very good statue of Pat Jennings. I checked very closely to see what jersey he's wearing. In fact, he's wearing the badge of Northern Ireland. We must have rinsed this. There cannot be any more Spurs fans or players commemorated in stone, in canvas, or in ceramic plaques anywhere left on these islands. Come on, I know you can do it. Thank you all for joining us. We'll be back, as I say, in the middle of the week to talk about Newcastle and much else besides by then. Just to remind you, the show has its own official home on Twitter at VFTL Podcast. And you can email us, VFTL@theathletic.com. And for all the best Spurs coverage anywhere from Charlie, Jack, and so many other excellent writers, make sure you just sign up to The Athletic. That's all for me. Spurs are 4th. Who really thought that was going to happen? Certainly not me. Let's see how it runs out. Bye-bye.
The Athletic.